I'd like to take us back to 1999. So 1999 is when the first iMac was released. Remember, it was Bondi Blue, it was a little bubble. 1999 was when Google had 8 employees. 1999 is also when many first-year graduate students in this audience were 9 years old. So something else happened in 1999, which is a bunch of researchers got together and they said, we see a future where there's this new class of computing device, wireless sensor networks, tiny embedded wireless devices that'll sense the physical world, stream this data in real time to us. We'll use this data to improve manufacturing, agriculture, medicine, all kinds of fantastic uses. Now, one of the big questions, the first questions that came up was, what would an operating system for these devices look like? What would an operating system for tiny wireless sensors look like? So TinyOS was one proposed answer to this question. It was designed to run on microcontrollers rather than processors. So think 8 to 16-bit bit architectures, no virtual memory. The first TinyOS devices had 500 bytes of RAM and 8 kilobytes of code. Modern ones have around 10 kilobytes of RAM and 50 of code. They're designed for ultra-low power operation, so a couple microamps when sleeping, a couple milliamps at most when awake. Wireless communication is thought to be critical. If you have hundreds of sensors, you don't want to run wires to them. But again, remember, this is 1999, so Wi-Fi is just starting to see significant deployment. You know, NS2, people still do simulations with a unit disk model for wireless networks. Like, it was a very different world with respect to what we knew and what we understood. So that was 1999. Now it's 13 years later. It's 2012. And TinyOS averages about 25,000 downloads a year. It has hundreds of thousands of nodes that it runs on. So it started as a research project at Berkeley, at UC Berkeley, just a bunch of Perl scripts stitching together C files. But now it has a worldwide community of hundreds of developers. There are hundreds of research papers that have used it, and some have even said, hey, there are better things we could do. And more recently, it's become a linchpin for research and development into the Internet of Things, which is basically Cisco market speak for a future in which most devices connected to the internet aren't laptops or desktops or mobile phones or servers, but rather embedded sensors that sense things, that sense the physical environment. So in this talk, I'm just going to try to explain a couple of the things that I think I learned in those years of TinyOS development. And the first two are going to be technical ones. So in the development of TinyOS, two sort of principles emerge that are absolutely critical for building embedded software that interacts with the physical world. And so I'm going to dig into those two principles and why they're so more important than in traditional systems. And for the second point, I'm going to talk about one programming approach, one sort of idiom that emerged over time, which turns out to be really powerful for meeting these two goals, something called static virtualization, which going forward I think is really valuable for embedded software. But so on one hand, I could talk about all the things, oh, you know, we do these technical things, they're great, embedded software is great. But sometimes the best lessons are maybe not the things you did, but the things you should have done. And so the last part of the talk, I'm going to talk about, I think, something, sort of a lesson learned about maybe there's something the project and the system we should have done differently going forward, that maybe we missed some opportunities. And if we could go back and do it differently, at least I think I probably would. So with that in mind, I need to make a really big disclaimer here. So TinyOS is the work of hundreds of people over a decade. It's, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours of work. I'm just one of those people. I'm the chair of the core working group. And in all honesty, you know, one of the little hidden secrets here is I wasn't actually even there when the project started. I was there about 18 months in. The first TinyOS code was in 1999, and I went to Berkeley as a graduate student in the summer of 2001. So this talk and everything within it are really my personal opinions and observations. So take them with a grain of salt. They could be completely wrong. First, let's talk about how you want to design embedded software. So I think there are really two principles that emerge, things that become really, really critical, which, you know, you don't have to focus as much in traditional software. And so the first is that you want to minimize the resources that you utilize. And by that, I mean RAM, I mean code space, I mean CPU cycles, I mean energy. So here, this table on the left shows a sampling of the MSP430 family of microcontrollers. So as I said, TinyOS and these tiny embedded systems focused on microcontrollers. And so you can look, the weakest ones have about a kilobyte of code space and about 100 bytes of RAM. The sort of the big powerful ones, which most of these systems actually gravitated towards, have about 50K of code space and about 10K of RAM. And so what happens in practice is that building applications and systems for these kinds of microcontrollers, you run up against these as really hard limits, like really hard to deal with. Well, listen, ask the question, wait, if code space and RAM is such a problem, why don't you not use a microcontroller? Why don't you use an ultra-low power processor? There are such things for embedded systems. The table on the right shows a family from TI of the ARM Cortex M3 processors. So these are ultra-low power ARM processors designed for embedded applications. You can see they have hundreds of kilobytes of code. They have 64 kilobytes of RAM, lots more resources. But you also look, their sleep current is a factor of 500 times higher. And so what this means is if you want to build a system that will last for a long time with one of these processors, this becomes a tremendously limiting factor. On a pair of AAs with a sleep current like this, the system doing absolutely nothing, only sleeping, will last for about 100 days. With a microcontroller, like one of the MSP430s, it'll last 10 years, longer than the expected lifetime or sort of the shelf life of the battery. And so in practice, what this means is that sleep current and the need to be low power just necessitated using microcontrollers. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward in the future. But microcontrollers with limited resources meant that applications really run into RAM and ROM code space and data space limitations. And so this means that every byte ends up being precious, and you really have to optimize for it. So the second principle is that you really have to structure your code, structure the system, structure your APIs to prevent bugs, much more so than traditional systems. And the reason for this is basically debugging is brutally, brutally difficult. So recall, here's this vision. We're going to have tons of these tiny little devices. They're going to be sprinkled in all kinds of crazy environments, observing, you know, volcanoes and trees and bridges and cars and medicine and our homes, all these sorts of environments. Well, you're deploying them to observe an unknown. If you knew what the sensor data was, there'd be no point deploying these nodes. And so you have this unknown input. And furthermore, they're interacting over a wireless network, which is very fickle and unpredictable by its own. And so you have essentially this piece of tightly optimized, highly embedded C code executing in response to unknown inputs and an uncontrolled environment. And you're trying to get just a little bit of data out, and so your output's actually really small. Debugging this is brutally, brutally difficult. There's no way to effectively attach a debugger once the system's deployed. Sure, you can do it in the lab, but the lab is a different environment, and there's scores of examples, you know, in experience papers of people finding that the application once deployed worked nothing like it did in the lab. And so in practice, this means that you just need to structure your code to prevent bugs as many as possible. The fewer you discover in the field, the happier you are. So next I want to talk about something that emerged sort of in about version 2.0 of TinyOS, this is around 2006, a programming approach or a way to structure operating system interfaces that tried to address these two goals, and I think did so pretty well. Something called static virtualization. So if you think traditionally, you know, I have my operating system, and it provides some abstractions of hardware resources, let's say, you know, files and timers. And normally what I do is I would dynamically at runtime make some system calls, and the operating system, say, in response, is going to allocate some state for files, allocate some state for these timers, you know, say, put them on a linked list, all is good. But there's a challenge in this, right, which is that the operating system is now performing some operations at runtime which can possibly fail. Say you get an enumem or something similar. Similarly, you're dealing with all these pointers, and pointers are to some degree wastes of memory. So instead, what emerged in TinyOS is this approach of when you compile your application, you state the operating system resources or abstractions you're going to need, and then the necessary state is going to be automatically allocated within the operating system for them. And so these are virtualized instances, each is independent, but yet the state needed for each of them is compiled within the OS statically. These are, rather than dealing with linked lists with pointers, you can just allocate arrays, and then you're using indexes into arrays. You can statically check these indices at compile time to know that the structures are safe. In addition to statically allocating all the memory that was needed, you can also statically bind all the functions. So for example, when the application calls into the operating system, because these two are compiled together and the function, the call path is known at compile time, you can actually optimize across that call boundary. This becomes even more interesting in the opposite direction. Callbacks in TinyOS didn't use function pointers. You know what function wants to be called back. Generally, it's the same one all the time, so there's no need to specify it at runtime. You can specify it at compile time. This means there are cases where an application, application code actually ends up being inlined and incorporated directly into an interrupt handler. You can just optimize across the full call boundaries. And so in practice, using this approach of static allocation meant that these embedded applications would allocate exactly the RAM that was needed, no more. You didn't, say, allocate any pointers for data structure. You didn't use any pointers for function pointers. It allows you to optimize across call boundaries such that you can actually inline, eliminate dead code, et cetera. You know, the entire call graph is known, so if a function is called by neither the OS or the application, you can just cut it out. But most of all, and this gets to the question of preventing bugs, it gives you a degree of compile time certainty. When you compile your application, you know that you're going to have enough memory. You know you're not going to have runtime failures in response to interesting call patterns because everything has been statically determined. You can look at the entire call graph. You can compute what the length of, say, an interrupt handler is because there's nothing which might change it at runtime. And so this concept of static virtualization was incorporated into TinyOS in version 2.0, which is around in 2006. And so here are just three sample papers I selected of people with deployment experiences using TinyOS. The first was this Great Duck Island deployment, which used a pre-version 1.0. And that observed packet delivery rates across a multi-op network of about 60%. Then there was a paper on some work done in 2005 using TinyOS 1.1. This is a deployment by some folks at Harvard of a volcano in Ecuador. And this is actually not packets, but events. Unfortunately, I couldn't find something with packet delivery reports for this period of time. And so they're seeing about 70%. So things are better, but they're still not great. But then post TinyOS 2.0 incorporated static virtualization. So suddenly you have this dependability and this reliability in terms of how the system will perform. Now people readily deploy applications which have, you know, sort of delivery and performance of 2.9. So this is an application deployed by some folks from Washington University at St. Louis in a hospital, in sort of the check-in area for a hospital. So people can carry around wireless sensors and the system is monitoring and streaming data about them. And so you see 2.9s of reliability. And by using static virtualization, we could actually start building networking stacks which provided this degree of reliability, which was exceedingly difficult beforehand, before you had it. And so, in total, this idea of having static virtualization of operating system services really enabled applications to go from something which was a struggle every time with teams of graduate students to something which people could just pretty easily build and deploy. So, I think that was a sort of a something successful that we did. That was way work. Hey, now people can build these really, you know, big, complex, interesting applications and get them to perform well. But in retrospect, I think there's actually something we actually might have not done right, in that there's something we could have done better. And there's sort of a lesson here in terms of how TinyOS progressed over time. And the lesson is something I like to call the island syndrome. So recall, the goal here is you want to be able to take these sensors and take these embedded systems and deploy them in all kinds of crazy environments. You want to, you know, instrument cars and volcanoes and trees and homes and manufacturing. And that's the end goal. We want to build applications. But what happened historically was that, I mean, TinyOS came out of a research community. Researchers aren't interested in building easy applications. They're interested in building hard ones. They're interested in pushing the boundaries of what's possible. And so what this meant was that, generally speaking, TinyOS users, especially the earlier ones who formed the core of the community, really were trying to push as to what you could do. They want to build the next big, fascinating, hard application no one had done before. And so this meant is that the operating system and all of its APIs and all of its structure focused on enabling them to do so. And in retrospect, doing so actually made it harder to do simpler things. So by making it harder to write bugs, we made it just plain also harder to write code, right? By making it easier to build hard applications, we actually also made it harder to build easier applications. And this was probably not a good idea. And so I call this the island syndrome because, based on a conversation I had with Alex Aiken, a programming languages colleague, where he said, you know, it's actually something you sometimes see where there's a community of developers that come around an idea or around a language, and over time the community grows, it incorporates new people, and then it builds a critical mass, right? It sort of becomes self-sustaining. At that point, it's Outlook, rather than looking outward in terms of how can we get new people using this, what are the new things we can do, it starts to look inward. How can we serve our existing users? How can we enable existing experts to do things better? And so at that point, your community goes from being this chunk of land to being an island, and it slowly drifts away from all of the people, you know, the people who are not already experts in the system. And so here's a timeline of the TinyOS project up until about 2010. There's more details on it in the paper. And that little orange bar is me. And so as you can see, there were a bunch of major releases that had technical sort of innovations that we added. We, in NestC 1.0 in 2002, we started using a new C dialect called NestC, or sorry, in TinyOS 1.0, we started using NestC and introduced the notion of bidirectional and parameterized interfaces. In 1.1, we introduced atomic statements to prevent data races and to allow more, you know, sort of far more reliable event-driven code, as well as a way to count our state. This is unique count used for things like static virtualization. In 2.0, we added generic components so you could instantiate code to reduce code copying. We added network types so that you wouldn't have to worry about bit packing packet structures and worrying about H2NL or H2NS anymore. You know, the whole compiler would just automatically generate you packets properly aligned and properly network byte order. And then in 2.1, we added memory safety and we added a threading system. But the thing is that if you look at all of these technical things that we added, all of these new mechanisms, new language features, new programming structures, new systems, only one of them was actually intended to make it easier to write applications, which is threads. All the rest of them were to allow it make it easier to build complex systems, hard systems. And so, correspondingly, over time, the system became better for experts to use, but harder for novices to use. And so I want to just show you one example of this, kind of what this looks like in practice when this happens, although I'm sure some of you have certainly seen it in other systems. So this is a simple application that just wants to send a packet every, say, 5 seconds. And so on the left, we have our application code. And at some point, the application is started by the boot sequence. And it starts a timer and says, oh, OK, start a timer every 5 seconds. And then has its callback, timer.fired, which, when it's called, will send a packet. And now remember, all this is going to be statically linked. There are no function pointers or anything. And then there's another file. This is the appc, the one in the center, where it instantiates the statically virtualized instance of a timer. That's new timer c. And then connects the application to that statically virtualized instance. That's that bottom line with that little arrow. It's a connection. So this is pretty simple from, you know, there's some stuff here about, oh, we have interfaces and we've got this arrow. So that's, you know, stuff you have to learn. Now, if you look underneath in the implementation, there's actually much more. So first, we need to, because we're accessing an array of timer structures, we need to know what our key into that structure is. So each static instance has to create a unique key. That's the call to unique. Then wires to the timer instance using this unique key so that you can distinguish different callers and callbacks of timer. So that's the second line of saying, oh, if there's an array of timer interfaces and we're going to use index TS. TS then ends up being turned into a parameter which is passed to the implementation of the statically virtualized service. So the first thing it does says how many keys are used. That's the call to UCount, unique count. How many calls to unique are there? It allocates an array of structures. On a clock interrupt, it scans across the structures. And it checks each of them to see if it should fire, decrements counters appropriately. Then at the bottom, you know, if one of them, when one of them starts, well, timer fired, then you start the timer and index into the structure. And so on one hand, we have static virtualization. It's great, allows you to build robust, efficient, dependable systems. On the other hand, if you look at what fraction of this code is regular C versus new stuff that we added, this is all the new stuff that we added to make this happen. And so, as you can imagine, as a novice coming to use this system, it actually can be kind of inaccessible. There's a lot of new terms, there's a lot of new features, a lot of new mechanisms you have to learn to even get started to start doing something simple. In contrast, when TinyOS first started, this way back 0.6, this is, you know, we got a bunch of C files and we link them with some Perl scripts. It was basically all C code with the exception of this one kind of file that would allow you to link functions. And so it's just kind of names of functions that are linked together. And this is when I started, right? So this was much simpler. You know, you had to kind of learn that, but it was a much, much lower barrier to entry for a novice user. And so generally what happened was the code evolved to use these NestC features in more and more complex and intricate ways in order to achieve these technical goals. So improving software dependability, allowing people to build complicated applications, have really, really efficient resource usage to serve the needs of the community, which happened to be existing TinyOS users. But by doing so, it increased the barrier to entry. It created this island syndrome where it kind of sailed off into the sunset. This happened in other places as well. So something called death by components. So one of the things, we're not exactly sure how we're going to build these systems, so let's build some really fine-grained component toolkits so we can connect all these components in interesting ways and figure out what the right compositions are. So a great way for building a system initially or evolving it, but the result is that the system, once you figure out what it should look like, has a whole bunch of tiny components linked together, and the actual structure of it is really hard for someone first coming to the system to understand. And so I think, in retrospect, we should have done is after we figured it out, we should have rewritten everything to have a much simpler structure. So just as an example of this, this is what the timer system actually looks like in TinyOS 2. So it's 10 components, 6 of which have executable code. That's the gray boxes. 4 of which are components that link components together. Those are the dashed boxes. So if you're a first-time user and you want to figure out how the timer system works, this is what you have to go through. You have to wade through all of this and figure out all of the structure just to understand how timers work. You know, in contrast, if we had just, after we'd figured that out and had it implemented and been stable for a year or so, said, look, we just need to rewrite this to have, oh, there's the part that, you know, sort of that abstracts away interrupts, that's the HPL, and then we just have a timer on top of it. Oh, and there's this thing about putting the processor to sleep when there isn't timer firing, that's it. We could have made it 4 components, and basically all the code would be in timer P, be really easy to understand in comparison, and would have been far more accessible. And so that's what you see, is that there's this notion that as you know, you're building up this technical complexity, sort of lose track of what's happening behind you, what it's like to enter the system. And this ultimately can be detrimental. Right? You can actually miss some opportunities. In particular, on one hand, I would say TinyOS has been really successful. You look at kind of some of the impact it had on the research community and some of the research and development today on things like the Internet of Things. But at the same time, there's been this huge upswelling of interest in do-it-yourself electronics and sensing systems. So when folks at the medical school want to like build a new, some kind of device or some kind of interface as part of their research, they don't use TinyOS, they use Arduinos, right? These very simple embedded sensing systems that have always remained really outward-looking and looking towards getting new users to use them. Getting started with an Arduino is absolutely trivial compared to TinyOS. In fact, you know, like Make Magazine, half the stuff in Make Magazine is about using Arduino to do neat things. And there's the Maker Fair in San Francisco, 20, 30,000 people show up to see all the kinds of things people are doing. You know, maybe if we approach things a little differently, TinyOS could have helped with them. The Arduino doesn't have much networking support. Imagine if it did. Imagine if people could build networked do-it-yourself electronics applications. That would be pretty cool. And so, in conclusion, I mean, TinyOS, I think, from an academic project standpoint, turned out to be really successful. It started as a bunch of Perl scripts, which you know stitched together C files. It now has you know 100 downloads a day, hundreds of thousands of nodes. There's a worldwide community of hundreds of developers. But in retrospect, I actually think if maybe we, you know, hindsight's 20/20, it could have been more so, where it missed being a platform for simple sensing applications, all this do-it-yourself stuff. The Arduino has taken that role. Also, while stuff that was done in TinyOS has become the basis for a lot of the work in, say, the IETF on connecting sensors to the internet, it's not actually the platform people use to do that, because it's kind of complicated. Instead, Contiki has emerged as a much simpler platform, basically just C-based, which you know, beg, borrowed, and stealed some concepts from TinyOS, but did so much better in an accessible way towards new users. And there's this notion of building applications for this domain, because it was this brand new domain sort of spearheaded by researchers, became hard applications. And hard applications meant increasing the technical complexity of the system. And so in retrospect, I think it would have been valuable to keep our eyes on the simple in the sense of what happens to a new user when they use the system, as opposed to just the complex, the existing users, and not to sort of sail off in this island. So again, my disclaimer, this is the work of hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of hours of work that made this possible. I'm just one of them, and these are just my personal opinions and observations. And I'm sure some of the people in the community agree, and some of them disagree, as they should. This is just my opinion. And so today, the latest version of TinyOS 2.1.2 released it in August, added a full IPv6 and Ripple networking stack for connecting to the Internet of Things. There's still a community. It's going strong. And so I'd love to take questions, but of course I'd like to thank a whole bunch of people for all the work that they've done. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for that talk. Mark Cherini, Harvard. So how difficult would it be to re-architect the interface to the style that you prefer for simple users, and would it be worth it?
I don't think it would be that hard to re-architect it. You could certainly just, in the end, there isn't that much code here, right? You can just write a brand new operating system to some degree. Would it be worth it? I think it could. I think it definitely could. On the other hand, Contiki, I think, to some degree, has filled in that role, right, where they've come up with more accessible C interfaces to many of the same services and abstractions, timers and sensors, et cetera. And so could certainly come up with a competing approach. They started a company, and now they're talking with companies, and they port stuff to those companies' architectures, et cetera. So I'm not sure that'd be really a fantastic place for a research group to go. But I think it totally would be possible.
Hi, I'm Aaron from Nicta and UNSW. Your analysis seems to make this crazy assumption that somehow lots of users is a good thing. I mean, building specialized software is hard. Do you think that if you make it easier to build software, is that the right metric for measuring a piece of software like this?
I don't think in all cases. I mean, in the sense that I think that if I had to choose going back between focusing on the hard things and building these complex systems and in some ways helping a research community and focusing on end users building simple applications, if I had to pick, I wouldn't have picked differently. Right? But my point is more that I think that we actually never really thought about the other class of actually keeping things simple for simple purposes. If we had, maybe we could have been able to do both. In this particular case, you're right, lots of users are not always valuable, but given this was seen as, there are people using similar systems, wouldn't it be kind of cool if you could build something which was useful to them?
Thanks.
Matthew Fernandez, also from Nicta and UNSW. I wanted to ask you, you said that doing simpler things, focusing on smaller things, would have made it easier rather than the complex things. So do you not think that would have prevented some research goals while enabling better usage for novices and industry?
In this particular case, I think probably no, actually. So in this particular case, I think actually no, because this is stuff which is happening up at basically the equivalent of main, right? What are the high-level sensing APIs that you use? Whereas a lot of the research and industry work was at much lower levels. So I think one good analogy you can see for this is that I look at something like Java, where one of the big educational challenges with Java when it first started being used educationally in 96, 97, was that main is actually kind of complicated, all the stuff that goes on in public static void main string, et cetera. And so one of the big efforts that occurred in the ACM was to come up with an alternative set of APIs for building simple applications. Those APIs don't change Java underneath. They don't make it any harder to build larger systems with Java, but they sort of add this level of simplicity for when you don't need all of that machinery.
So most of the changes you're saying are essentially making things simpler for experts, but things that they could have done otherwise.
I know, sorry, by simpler for experts.
So you're saying that they were enabling things that could have been done otherwise, but just with more verbosity, essentially.
Yes, that they're making it easier to do simple things.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So just to follow up on that, this is Eric Sudler from Oracle. We've done this sunspot thing for many years where you put, a micro version of Java into the sensors. And so I'm curious because you're you have this conflict that the last speaker mentioned about, you know, research goals versus usability, and I think that's because it's easy to publish results showing something quantifiable, the amount of power or the performance, but it's hard to quantify usability. Trying to bridge this gap, do you have any thoughts on how do you publish research saying this is more usable?
Well, so I think part of the challenge there is that the folks who generally publish that kind of research, like Kai and Wist, their bar for what is usable is so much higher than us, right? The stuff that we do is not going to necessarily be easy to publish there. In some ways, it might not be a publishable result, I think, actually. That would be kind of tricky in the sense of it's looking at a domain which this particular community often is not super, you know, focused on. Oh, I could build a really simple sensing app in two lines. Okay. That being said, from a research standpoint, there are certainly researchy sides of what's going on. For example, there are some folks who've published papers on essentially using TinyOS, but like gum sticks for how do you have people prototype sensing control systems like through action. So you shake something and collect the sensor data to say this is the input that I want to denote do something, like when I shake it. And then you can say, oh, that's the chunk there. You just, whenever you detect something like that, then take this action using basically a state programming model. So in that way, if you really want to look at sort of novel ways of making a system more easily programmable, there's absolutely research space. But like, hey, we came up with these six functions rather than those 10. That's a great question. My guess is that's a very hard road.
Hi. Luis Pedroso, University of Southern California. I worked with quite a few of these operating systems, in particular with TinyOS for more than 5 years. So
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize, actually.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I enjoyed being on the island.
All right.
To the most part, for the most part, I actually attribute a lot of the high learning curve not to the inward complexity and the targeting to this very specific user base, but mainly to the lack of tools on top of it. I think anyone here would agree that if we all had to write Java code using your analogy for Java in Notepad, and not Eclipse or NetBeans or whatever, no one would want to use Java. How much would you attribute to that?
So I think that's totally fair. I think tools could have certainly made things easier, but they wouldn't solve the fundamental problem, right? In the sense that this code still includes, I mean, I'm assuming that the novice knows C, right? And is, you know, accustomed to event-driven programming. That's the novice in this circumstance. I think it's clear that tools could have helped with respect to managing source and looking up functions, but you know, that's also not a systems, at least, you know, the perspective of like writing Eclipse is not really a systems-y research problem, which is easy for a research group to try to tackle. So in that way, I think you're right, that would have helped a lot, absolutely true, but I think these fundamental issues in terms of the structure of the code would have also remained.
Thank you.